Blog Talk Radio.
Healing rain is coming down. It's coming nearer to this old town. The rich and poor, and strong, it's bringing mercy, it won't be long. Healing rain is coming down, it's coming closer to the lost and found. Tears of joy, tears of shame, a wash forever in Jesus' name. The healing rain, it comes with fire, so let it fall and take us higher. The healing rain, I'm not afraid.
Welcome to the Cross in the Desert. Good morning. We are speaking all the time, hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble, on this Monday morning edition, and I hope that you're going to have a great day and the start of a new work week. I know for me, vacation has officially ended at 2:30 today, back to work, but I've had an incredible time. Wonderful interview last Monday with Nagma Ambedini and then with Banap Shay on Thursday. I had my book signing on Saturday, a really fruitful time, kind of a working vacation, but I'm doing the things I love, doing the things that I enjoy. So it's back to the normal routine, if you will, but it's been a great time off to succeed in doing the things that I'm passionate about. Today on the Cross in the Desert, I'm going to switch our focus a little bit away from Iran. Just for today, I want to focus in on the humanitarian effort of the United States in helping the Yazidi community that is in Iraq. The Yazidis are an interesting minority group living in Iraq. They are a Kurdish-speaking ethno-religious community, and they are practicers of the ancient syncretic religion linked to Zoroastrianism. And so there were thousands of them, including a group of Christians as well, stranded on a mountaintop. All of us were, I'm sure, riveted to our TVs, watching the plight of these persecuted people as ISIS marched in to destroy, to commit genocide. And thankfully, my country has responded by allowing humanitarian aid, food and water to be dropped to these precious people on this very dangerous mountaintop. In fact, I think on Friday I heard that some of the parents were actually hurling their children off the mountaintop so they would not have to be hurt and killed by the terrorists. So it was just a chaotic scene. And we're going to get the latest on what is going on. I've got a series of sound bites here for you to get a perspective on what has been taking place in the last few days in Iraq, specifically with the Yazidi community. I want us to hear several reports. So right now on the Cross in the Desert, we're going to focus in on this group and find out what's happening with them on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
U.S. warplanes struck targets in Iraq today for the first time since American troops pulled out in 2011. Our chief foreign affairs correspondent, Margaret Warner, has the story.
Smoke rose over Erbil as U.S. airstrikes hit fighters of the militant Islamic State group in the north. A pair of F-A-18s like these carried out the strikes. The Pentagon said they dropped two 500-pound bombs on artillery that was shelling Kurdish forces. Later, warplanes and unmanned drones struck again, hitting a mortar and a convoy of vehicles.
America is coming to help.
President Obama announced the military action last night as new advances by the Islamic State fighters threaten minority Christians and Yazidis. Thousands have fled in terror and are stranded on Sinjar Mountain without food or water.
When we face a situation like we do on that mountain, with innocent people facing the prospect of violence on a horrific scale, when we have a mandate to help, and when we have the unique capabilities to help avert a massacre, then I believe the United States of America cannot turn a blind eye. We can act carefully and responsibly to prevent a potential act of genocide.
He also announced airdrops of humanitarian aid. Overnight, cargo planes took in 5,300 gallons of water and 8,000 prepackaged meals. Islamic State forces are also threatening the city of Erbil, capital of the Kurdistan Regional Government, whose Peshmerga fighters have been routed in battles this week with the Islamic State group. Its officials welcomed U.S. action.
We thank Barack Obama again due to his decision that he will give military support to the Peshmerga. He also makes sure that Kurdistan is the place for religious minorities.
But the Kurds' foreign minister, Mustafa Bakir, told me this afternoon their Peshmerga forces need a lot more from the U.S. in equipment and training. He said, quote, our weapons are not sufficient against those used by this terrorist group and the tactics they are carrying out along our very long border with them.
Islamic State fighters were defiant. One told Reuters that the airstrikes would have, quote, no impact on us. Back in Washington, leaders of both parties supported the move, but some Republicans called for tougher measures. Senators John McCain of Arizona and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina said in a statement, these actions are far from sufficient to meet the growing threat. We need a strategic approach, not just a humanitarian one. A policy of containment will not work. It was unclear how extensive the air campaign may be, but the president vowed again last night not to send combat troops back into Iraq. The U.S. has had 800 military personnel there since June as advisors to Iraqis and Kurds and security for U.S. facilities. Meanwhile, the political deadlock in Baghdad persists. Today, Iraq's top Shiite cleric issued his strongest call yet for Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to go. Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Tustani spoke through a representative in Karbala.
Insisting on staying in government posts, despite negative effects on the country, is a terrible mistake, and any politician should avoid that.
The White House said again today the extent of future U.S. support depends on the formation of an inclusive Iraqi government.
We'll have much more on all this, including an interview with the Deputy National Security Advisor at the White House right after the news summary.
Desperation on a mountaintop. Kurdish civilians, some clearly wounded, baking in the August sun. This little girl crying, I lost my sister and brother. Where is my mother? With every passing day, Kurdish officials say more people die here of dehydration and exposure to the extreme August heat. Kurdish officials say tens of thousands of people from the Yazidi religious minority fled to this mountain ridge to escape ISIS militants who recently captured the nearby town of Sinjar. ISIS have the Yazidis surrounded, the trapped people relying on airdrops of vital water and food delivered by the U.S. and Iraqi air forces. Kurdish TV released this footage of a helicopter delivering assistance to the same area. A lucky few make it on board the flight to safety. Their faces pretty much say it all. Not far away, ISIS militants have been celebrating their latest advances, showing off their control of the Mosul Dam, a strategic piece of Iraqi infrastructure. If it breaks, it could flood all the way down to the capital, Baghdad. Further east, U.S. airstrikes appear to have slowed the ISIS advance, bombing suspected ISIS positions just west of the Zab River, just 20 minutes' drive away from Erbil. Kurdish officials relieved and thankful for the U.S. intervention.
We are most grateful and express our gratitude and deep, deep appreciation for President Obama and the U.S. administration and for the courageous U.S. Army and airmen who are now patrolling the skies of Iraq and Iraqi Kurdistan.
U.S. air power has given the Kurdish administration in Erbil the opportunity to bolster its defenses around this fragile sanctuary in the north, where hundreds of thousands of Iraqis fled to escape the ISIS advance. Ivan Watson, CNN, Erbil in Iraqi Kurdistan.
Well, this was a beautiful thing to behold, to see the U.S. humanitarian aid to these very, very troubled minority group in Iraq, the Yazidis. that had their backs up against the wall. You know, it reminded me in the book of Exodus during biblical times when the Jewish people were being pursued by Pharaoh and his armies, and God miraculously opened up the Red Sea so his people could cross to safety into the Promised Land and then close down the huge waves and drown the Pharaoh and his chariots. This reminded me a little bit of that, and I was so grateful to see this humanitarian aid being dropped to these starving, hurting people who had their backs literally up against the wall. Burned by the sun, blistered with thirst and weak from exhaustion, thousands of Yazidis on Sunday fled the mountain on which they had been trapped for a week, streaming into Iraq's northern Kurdistan region after a harrowing escape from extremist fighters that some said was aided by U.S. airstrikes. Hungry, thirsty and tired, they limped across a narrow bridge spanning the Tigray on the Iraqi soil and Syrian border, hauling their few belongings, some of them barefoot, others in sleeping clothes because they ran for their lives at night. It was the last leg of a nightmarish journey that some have not survived and many may not. It was incredible to watch. Now, yet there are still thousands stranded on the mountain, either because they are surrounded in their villages by militants with the Islamic State or are simply too weak to walk, according to those arriving in the remote Iraqi border post of Fishkabur. Now, others have died trying to reach safety, falling by the wayside on the barren Rocky Mountain for lack of food and water. One person, Barat Gahan Hassan, who is 75, said, "We passed dead people on the way." He had walked for 2 days with his wife and their three-year-old grandson, Amen. So it's just amazing when you see this region where they were trapped in, on this huge, barren, rocky mountain, and because of our airstrikes, because of the humanitarian aid, some of these precious people have been able to leave this mountain and flee to another village and are safe. Many, many have died because of starvation, because of illness, because of just being hurt and tired, and it's just an amazing thing to watch. Please keep these people in your thoughts and prayers as we continue to make airstrikes against the ISIS group and also with the humanitarian aid. This is a wonderful, beautiful thing to watch, and I'm so glad the United States is able to provide this kind of help and support to this needy, needy people. I want to continue on keeping us focused on this subject this morning. We're going to talk more about what's going on now with ISIS planning to carry out their threats on U.S. homeland. This brutal, genocidal terrorist group must be stopped at all costs. And so we're going to hear more about it right now on the cross in the desert.
Look elsewhere.
You know, you really can't exaggerate this, Aaron. It is a big threat, and it's a growing threat, and I hear it from so many U.S. officials and so many agencies here. Let's talk about the immediate threat from ISIS. Right now, here, just to the east of Mosul, you have a massacre looming. 40,000 Yazidis, a religious minority in Iraq, surrounded by ISIS fighters. Really, this is a Srebrenica. It's a Rwanda potentially in the making. Just to the east of there, in Erbil, you have more than 100 U.S. military advisors and ISIS forces advancing there, threatening them. That of great concern to the White House. But let's also talk about the medium and longer-term threat. This is the ISIS positions in Iraq just about 6 weeks ago, middle of June. Just in a 6 weeks' time, this is how much territory they have gained. And when I speak to U.S. officials, they tell me there is no sign of ISIS giving up that territory, and in fact, no sign of Iraqi forces gaining it back. That is of enormous concern to U.S. officials and why they are considering airstrikes now.
These are the people the U.S. is rushing to protect. Tens of thousands of minority Yazidis. They're now surrounded by ISIS fighters in a small northern Iraqi town, only for some of them to die there of hunger and thirst. Pleading for their lives inside the Iraqi parliament, a Yazidi lawmaker collapsed with emotion.
Over 500 men have been slaughtered. Mr. Speaker, our women are being killed or sold as slaves. There is a collective attempt to exterminate the Yazidi people.
Faced with a growing humanitarian crisis, the U.S. has launched a mission to drop emergency aid to the stranded Yazidis. It is also considering opening a humanitarian corridor to allow them to escape. and potential airstrikes on ISIS targets to protect U.S. military advisors now stationed in Erbil.
The cold and calculated manner in which ISIL has targeted defenseless Iraqis, like the Yazidis and Christians, solely because of their ethnic and religious identity, demonstrates a callous disregard for human rights, and it is deeply disturbing.
ISIS is capable of alarming brutality, including mass executions of anyone who is not a Sunni Muslim or who will not immediately convert. All recorded for the world to see in slickly produced videos like this one. Iraqi forces say they are striking ISIS positions in the northern Iraqi cities of Tikrit and Mosul. However, ISIS is making further gains, today reclaiming the crucial Mosul Dam, which supplies electricity to what has now become the capital of a self-declared Islamic caliphate in Iraq. ISIS is also targeting Christians, attacking three more villages around Nineveh province, forcing hundreds of Christian families to flee for their lives. A senior intelligence official tells CNN that ISIS is now, quote, well-positioned to keep the territory it has captured.
And let's be clear here. ISIS does not just threaten the region. It also threatens the U.S. We know that ISIS is planning and aspires to carry out attacks on the U.S. homeland. And that is just one failed state with one terror group that targets the U.S. I had a briefing with senior intelligence officials today, and they made this point. There are now, in effect, four failed states in the region with terror groups who are targeting the U.S. You have Al-Murabitun here. It's an al-Qaeda group. You have al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, in Yemen, an effective failed state, at least in parts of the country. It has already attempted three attacks on the U.S. homeland. Then, of course, you have al-Shabaab, also concerns about returning American fighters who have joined al-Shabaab, concerns that they would come out to the U.S. and carry attacks. This is what counterterror officials face every day, and they are increasing concern as these states fail, what that means for safety back here at home.
And there you hear the situation of what's going on with ISIS. We talk a lot about the way they are treating minority groups, those that are non-Sunnis, those that are Christians especially. There are reports of not only crucifixions but beheadings. And as I was thinking about what's going on with the Christians in Iraq, how they are under such intense persecution, that there was once over a million Christians in Iraq. It's dwindled down to less than 100,000 because of the persecution. I'm thinking specifically about the words of Jesus warning us the cost of following him. And I came across this passage in my Bible reading this morning that is apropos to what is happening to the Christians in Iraq and how Jesus has warned us in advance the cost of following him. He says, Matthew chapter 10, verse 16, "Behold, I am sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. So be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. Beware of men, for they will deliver you over to courts and flog you in their synagogues. And you will be dragged before governors and kings for my sake to bear witness before them and the Gentiles. When they deliver you over, do not be anxious how you are to speak or what you are to say, for what you are to say will be given to you in that hour. For it is not you who will speak, but the Spirit of your Father speaking through you. Brother will deliver brother over to death, and the father his child, and children will rise against parents and have them put to death. And you will be hated for all, or you will be hated by all for my name's sake, but the one who endures to the end will be saved." The words of Jesus are right on target, and you will be hated by all for my name's sake. And Jesus is warning us that the world is not friendly to us. John chapter 15 also comes to mind when I think about this. "If the world hates you, you know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love you, its own. But because you are not of the world, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you." Following Jesus, identifying with the light of the world, the light that speaks against the darkness. And this group is demonstrating exactly what Jesus warned us about. We will be hated. Not only misunderstood, but hated. Why are Christians so persecuted and hated? Well, because Jesus is the embodiment of truth, the embodiment of love, the embodiment of holiness. And the light of who he is shines in the darkness, exposing our sin. And let's be honest, no one likes to have their sins exposed. Light is hitting darkness right in the Middle East. And ISIS is responding to that light with more hatred, with more persecution. You see, Christians have the love, the compassion, the light of Christ. And if we're walking in fellowship with him, our light is shining bright. And the world hates that light. Because we as Christians, again, because we follow Jesus, we follow in his footsteps, we carry the truth in our hearts, and we shine forth his love in a dark world. And so Christians, because of that, suffer martyrdom, suffer death, suffer persecution. And the reports are that many of the ISIS are beheading Christians. This is very hard to understand. It's very, very hard to explain and to watch. But there is an interview I want to take you to that explains more about what ISIS is doing right here on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
A California businessman is calling on the U.S. to do more to help Christians being persecuted in Iraq. Mark Arabo is a prominent leader of the Chaldean community, a Christian community, an ancient one that is now literally being threatened with disappearance. He joins us from San Diego, California. Thanks so much for being with us. It sounds, frankly, like a nightmare. A group of extremists bent on atrocities is now openly and officially targeting Christians in Iraq. What's going on?
This is truly a living nightmare that's not going away. Christianity in Mosul is dead, and a Christian Holocaust is in our midst. 7 weeks ago, we went to Washington, D.C., and we actually were calling this a Christian genocide. And since then, day by day, it's getting worse and worse. More children are being beheaded. Mothers are being raped and killed. The fathers are being hung. Right now, 300,000 Christians are in Iraq, fleeing, living in neighboring cities, just wanting a chance not just to survive, but to live. And we've been calling on State Department. We had a meeting at the White House last week with Ben Rhodes, myself and other Chaldean community leaders throughout the country. And what we're saying is folks should follow Francis' lead. They should offer asylum. The world community should come together. We've had tremendous success in Washington with Congressman Juan Vargas offering H.R. 683.
I want to go back. Forgive me for interrupting. I want to go back to something you said, because the atrocities committed by ISIS are well known, but still you're startling me with the severity of what you're describing. You say they are beheading children?
They are systematically beheading children and mothers and fathers. The world hasn't seen an evil like this for generations. There's actually a park in Mosul that they've actually beheaded children and put their heads on a stick, and they have them in the park. This is crimes against humanity. The whole world should come together. This is much broader than a community or a faith. This is crimes against humanity, and they're doing the most horrendous, the most heartbreaking crimes you could think of.
Now, I want to ask you specifically about what happened in Mosul, because it was widely reported that when ISIS took control of Mosul, which, depending on how you do the numbers, is the second largest city in Iraq, they gave Christians an ultimatum, which would be to convert to Islam, to pay a fine, or, in their phrase, death by the sword. It's very clear they are killing people, but are Christians managing to escape by paying a fine? Are the ones who cooperate at least assured of any safety?
Sure. So the letter that they sent out with those three items, they did ask to pay a fine, but they're actually, after they pay a fine, they're actually taking over their wives and their daughters and making them into their wives. So really it's convert or die, face death by the sword. Christians, 95% of all Christians in Mosul have fled, and 5% have converted. They've marked the red death stamp of ISIS on Christian homes and basically saying, we know who you are, and if you come back, you will get killed.
This is almost a kind of a plague out of biblical times. They're literally marking the doors of Christian homes?
Yeah, they are, and with the historian with the letter N, to mark them as Christians, And that's why we're saying this is a Christian Holocaust within our midst, and the world community cannot turn a blind eye on something so tragic. So much of crimes are coming out. Children are being beheaded. Folks are being killed just because they're being Christian. It's happening right now. And France is leading the way. We're hoping other countries, we hope the United Nations, recognize this as a Christian genocide. We hope everyone steps up and offers these folks a home, because this should never be happening in 2014. It is.
Now, you're using the word genocide, and I, once again, acknowledging the atrocities of the crimes that have been committed by ISIS. Genocide is a very powerful word. Do you literally think that ISIS is trying to kill all of the Christians who fall in its hands?
They're absolutely killing every Christian they see. This is a genocide in every sense of the word. And they want everyone to convert, and they want Sharia law to be the law of the land. And we're talking about a place where Christianity was founded over 1,800 years ago. They bombed the church last week. That was an 1,800-year-old church. And they're systematically destroying churches. They've already bombed six churches in the area.
And no one stopped them. Mark Arable, speaking on behalf of the Christians of Iraq, thanks so much for talking to us.
The Naked Color, NRDHF.org. Thank you.
It's difficult to hear this, and yet the reality of a Christian genocide is taking place before our eyes in the heart of the Middle East, in Iraq. The words of Jesus are very sobering. He warned us about the cost of following him. Let's read Luke chapter 9, 23. And he said to all, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory and the glory of his Father and of the holy angels. Whoever would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me." These words, in the backdrop of the reality of what's happening in Iraq, the Iraqi Christians understand and know firsthand the cost of being marked as a Christian, the cost of being a follower of Jesus, the reality. All of us need a wake-up call here that live in the comfortable West. We don't have the intense trials like these precious Iraqi Christians do. We can learn of their endurance. We can learn of their commitment. So many times when I see their pictures, I'm thinking of my freedom, and I'm pausing and praying for them, realizing that right now their life is anything but freedom. It is chaos. It's a nightmare. If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up the cross daily and follow me. I want to take you now into, this is a summary of Christian persecution from the beginning. This is from a Christian film from a couple of years ago called Love Costs Everything, and literally it does. I want you to hear this as it puts in perspective the suffering and persecution of Christians right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
Since its inception, the church has struggled against the face of persecution. Stephen became the first follower of Jesus to die for his faith, stoned to death for speaking out against the religious leaders of that day. His execution sparked mass persecution across Jerusalem. 10 years later, James would become the first apostle to be executed, followed by all the other disciples except for John, who was exiled to an island and then died of natural causes. As Christianity spreads throughout the Roman Empire, so does persecution. In 64 AD, Nero burns Rome for his new palace, killing thousands of Romans. When the emperor is suspected, he blames the Christians, who are then doused with pitch and used as human torches to light the palace. That same year, Peter is crucified upside down, and the Apostle Paul is beheaded. In 160 AD, the Apostle John appoints Polycarp as a bishop of the Christian church. Later, he is threatened to recant his beliefs. He responds, 86 years I have been his servant, and he has done me no wrong. How then can I blaspheme my king who saved me? Then they burn Polycarp at the stake. 203 AD, Perpetua, the daughter of an affluent man, is beheaded in front of her father for not recanting Jesus Christ. Perpetua assists her executioners when the sword gets stuck halfway through her neck. 1,000 years go by, faith goes global, persecution follows. July 6, 1415, John Huss and William Tyndale are both burned at the stake for translating the Bible into their own language, English. This was the first step for the Protestant Reformation in Europe. Japan, 1630, 300,000 Christians are executed by beach crucifixion, upside down in the morning low tide, so they wouldn't drown until the tide came in at the end of the day. 20th century, the bloodiest century in the history of the church. World War II, Lutheran pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer was put to death in 1945 for refusing to comply with Hitler's plot against the Jews. 1950, Jim Elliot is speared to death by Aucan Indians in South America when he arrives by plane to share the gospel of Jesus Christ. That next summer, his wife comes and baptizes the man that killed her husband. 1975, Chinese pastor Wang Ziming is executed by communist regimes. Pastor Ziming attempted to bring freedom of worship to Christians in this oppressed country. 2006, former North Korean army officer Song Jong-nam is arrested by communist leaders for preaching Christianity. He eventually dies in prison. 2010, Afghanistan, Saeed Musa is arrested for converting to Christianity. While facing extreme physical torture, Musa's captors inform him that he will be released if he denies Jesus. He refuses and remains in prison. Word of his plight spreads to the United States. A massive social networking campaign follows, and church and political leaders plead for his release. Finally, after months of captivity, Musa is freed. Persecution of Christians still continues today. In nearly every corner of the world, Christians are told that they cannot worship freely.
You're listening there to a brief summary, a brief history, that is, of the reality of Christian persecution, committed Christians standing up for their faith and losing their lives. You know, today, lots of the church teaching is about health, wealth, and prosperity. It's such an antithetical thing we're listening to. The lure of health, wealth, and prosperity is a false gospel. It's not what Jesus taught. And so many in the church today are allowing their lives to be seduced by the promise of health, wealth, and prosperity, when what we do see in the Middle East is the absolute opposite, committed Christians suffering for their faith. That's the reality of the Christian life, and this is something that the church needs to awaken to. Well, in the midst of all this chaos, we need a breath of fresh air. We need comfort right now. And the comforting thought is, in all of these trials and persecutions, God never leaves or forsakes us. He constantly holds on to us. He never lets us go. This is the song I want to play for you right now, On the Cross in the Desert, a beautiful song remembering the love of God, how he never lets us go. Here's Matt Redman right now, On the Cross in the Desert.
My God is with me.
Words of truth and words of comfort from an incredible worship musician, writer, Christian statesman, Matt Redman. You Never Let Go. It's a song of comfort to remind us that in the midst of the chaos and the suffering, our God of love does not let go of us. But when we see the chaos and the suffering surrounding us, like we've seen what's going on with the Iraqi Christians and the Yazidis, and Christians are often tempted to ask the question that all of us are asking. Maybe some of us don't like to ask it out loud. We're thinking about it. But lots of us, if we're honest, are saying, God, why do you allow so much suffering and evil? It's an age-old dilemma. It's an age-old question. Sometimes this can be a stumbling block for Christians. It can be a barrier for the non-Christian who thinks that, well, if your God is all-powerful and all-loving, why suffering? Why evil? When I was putting together this program, I thought and anticipated that if I talk about the intense persecution of Christians, the amount of bloodshed and violence that's being committed by ISIS, I really anticipated lots of Christians are going to want to know why. Lots of non-Christians themselves would say, why? Why so much suffering and evil? Well, I hear what you're saying, and I think there are good, solid answers to this. It's a difficult dilemma. It's a tough question for lots of us. But just recently, John Ankerberg had a very famous theologian and philosopher, and they did a series together about why God allows suffering and evil. And I found some of these questions and answers were very insightful, and I think would be very helpful to what we're witnessing into the world right now. And so what I'm going to do, I got several of these sound bites I want to play for you. The first one is, what is evil? Why did God permit it? And Norman Geisler tackles a difficult question. What I found so helpful is that these are not trite answers. These are well-thought-out answers, because all of us as Christians need to deal and confront with this issue. And I think what I'm going to try to do in the remaining 20 minutes of my program today is give you a foundation for your faith, a strength for your faith, that maybe you can actually use some of these answers when you're asked these questions by those that are friendly to the Christian faith, maybe, and those that are hostile, that want to know answers. I think that this is something important for us to know about. So what I'm going to do right now is going to play the first clip, What is Evil? I'm going to come back and make a few comments, and we'll go through these clips systematically, and let's flesh out some answers to this thorny question of why evil and suffering in a good God universe. We're going to hear one of the answers right now on the cross in the desert.
Suffering, but before we do, give us the big picture of what God intended here. What is evil? Where did it come from? Why permit it? Where are we going?
The big picture is there's an all-good God who made good creatures, gave those good creatures a good thing called free will. They abused that freedom and brought evil in the universe. God knew that was going to happen, and he had pre-planned to bring a greater good out of evil. This is not the best of all possible worlds, as Leibniz said in his Theodicy. And Candide wrote the satire on it, saying that this is not the best of all possible worlds. But it is the best of all possible ways to get to the best of all possible worlds. And the big picture is this. The best of all possible beings, God, made the best of all possible worlds, which was one in which we're free. We brought evil. He's going to bring a greater good out of it in the end, so that by permitting evil, he is going to defeat evil. He's going to separate the good from the evil, which has to be done, because evil is what frustrates good people. Good is what frustrates evil people. I used to work on the assembly line in Detroit when I was going through school, and what frustrated me? People telling their filthy stories, blowing their smoke in my face. You know what frustrated them? Me reading my Bible, testifying to them. Well, God has a solution. The wheat and the tares grow together till the harvest. Finally, they're separated, and there's a place where there's no more evil that frustrates good people. It's called heaven. And there's a place where there's no more good that frustrates evil people.
Well, if you look at the bigger picture, that God has a purpose in our suffering, it's not purposeless. There is a purpose. and that in spite of the evil in the world, God brings a greater good out of it. We can think of the crucifixion, an evil thing that was performed on him, and yet the greater good out of Christ's death, burial, and resurrection was the salvation of those that trust him. There was a greater good that came out of the suffering and evil. So I think what Norman Geisler is saying is that this is not the best of all possible worlds, but it's a stepping stone to the best of all possible worlds, and in the end, God will win, bringing great good out of suffering and evil. Okay, I think that's getting us to think, but still lots of us are saying, why does God allow so much physical suffering? This will take a little bit longer to explain, and the topic is about the Holocaust, and let's try to get some answers to why God allows physical suffering right here, right now on the cross in the desert. Here is John Ankerberg and Norman Geisler once again.
I was in a social event where I met two older folks. And as kids, they had both been in the Holocaust. And the man had grown up in Auschwitz and some of the other camps. And as a young child, he had watched other children cut up and killed right in front of him. So he left his belief in God and we got talking. Why such cruelty? Why such sin and suffering, pain, terrorism? Why does an all-loving God permit this? You need to help us out here in a big-time way. Why does God allow physical suffering?
Well, there are two points I'd like to make there, John. One is made by Rabbi Kushner, strangely enough, in his book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. He interviewed a lady who had been through the Holocaust, and she said, it never occurred to me to blame God for the Holocaust. God was not the cause of this event. Wicked, sinful human beings were the cause of the event. Second thing is that isn't it interesting that some people get bitter through suffering and some people get better through suffering? So it must be a key. Johnny Erickson Tada is a good example of somebody who got better through suffering. The atheist and the agnostic gets bitter. Depends on how you respond to it. If you respond to it positively, saying, I don't understand it completely, but I believe that God is loving, he has a good purpose for this, and he'll bring about his good purpose, then you'll grow through it. It'll be a stepping stone. If you charge God foolishly, as Job's phrase reminds us, then you're going to get bitter because you're charging the one in the universe who can do something about it, who loves you, who's allowed this to happen for a good purpose in your life, and you're just going to get bitter as a result rather than better. It's going to be a stumbling stone rather than a stepping stone.
Yeah, but when you lost your daughter, as you were talking about last week, you probably were with a lot of other people that there are moments where you say, why? You want to understand why, okay? What we need your help on, what went through your mind when that event happened, how did you put that in context? Because it really, really hurt.
It never occurred to me to blame God. See, if you have the proper biblical view of God going into an experience like that, it makes all the difference in the world. I knew God is loving. I knew God is all-powerful. I knew God had a good purpose, even if I couldn't figure out what the purpose was. There's a big difference in not knowing why and knowing the one who does know why. At least I know why, I don't know why. I'm finite, I'm fallible, I don't know everything. But I know the one who does know why. And you can get through a situation if you don't know why, if you know the one who does know why. And you know he's a divine architect of the universe, as Paul Harvey said, who doesn't build a staircase that leads to nowhere. If it looks like it's going nowhere, mark it down. It's going somewhere, and God knows where it's going. And if you keep on the path, he's going to show you.
I think that what Norman Geisler says is so true. What is our view of God? Who do we believe him to be? Do we know his character? He's loving. He's trustworthy. He's faithful. And instead of getting bitter, we should get better when we go through trials. But another person will say, okay, God is a good God. He's all-powerful. But why doesn't he stop all evil? And let's get an answer to that question right now.
He loves us. He doesn't want that kind of thing for us, but he has permitted it, okay? But he also has the power to stop it anytime he wants to. People want to know, why is it that he hasn't stopped it? Why doesn't he stop it right now if he's got the power to do so?
Well, we could stop an operation right in the middle, too, and say this is too painful, but it would be the wrong time to stop it, wouldn't it? We could stop the dentist right in the middle of the dentist chair, but it would be the wrong time. He's got to get the abscess tooth out, and God knows the right time. And he knows how much tribulation is going to work patience and how much pain is necessary to produce the greater good in our life. If he's all-knowing, he knows the right amount and the right time. If he's all good, he'll give his goodness in producing that greater good in our life. So while we think that it's too long, and we cry out, how long, O Lord, as Isaiah said, he knows exactly how much is needed in our life to achieve what he's trying.
It comes down to trusting an infinite God who knows exactly what he's doing. He created this universe. He maintains this universe. He is sovereign, and he is in control of this universe. But what does the presence of evil tell us about who God is? Let's get an answer to that question right now.
All right, frame it. We've only got a few minutes left. What does the content that we've even discussed today, first of all, tell us about the God we're talking about?
It tells us that he's all good. It tells us that he's all powerful. If he's all good, he has a good purpose for everything that happens. If he's all powerful, he can bring a good out of evil. And he's all knowing, so he knows where this thing is going. He's not a divine architect of the universe that builds staircases that lead to nowhere. Every staircase that looks like it's going nowhere to us is going somewhere to him, and you can be sure of it.
How is it encouraging? How is it good for us to know the nature of evil?
All is good that ends good. All is well that ends well, we say. So if we know that it's just temporary, if we know it has a good purpose in mind, then we can endure it a whole lot more easily than if we don't know where it's going and we don't know there's anyone who knows where it's going.
Why is it good to know that evil originated with free choice and God didn't create it?
Because then you know that God is absolutely good. You know that God is not evil in any sense. Because if he originated evil, then he's evil.
And how can a person who says, you know, I'd like to come into a relationship with that God, I didn't even know that I could, how do you get to know him personally? What has he made possible for us?
He's made possible for us a solution to evil. See, and the encouraging thing is this God is not only all-powerful, but he's all-loving. And he's permitting this evil for a purpose. In fact, he permitted the greatest evil that has ever occurred on earth to his own son. He permitted him to go to the cross, to die for our sins, to rise from the dead, that we can be delivered from evil. So God permitted evil to defeat evil. He permitted his son's suffering so that we wouldn't have to suffer forever. He permitted evil in our lives to remind us, as Lewis said in his great book, The Problem of Pain, evil is God's megaphone to arouse a morally deaf world. And so all these evil circumstances are to turn us to God. I was lying in the hospital in 1954 with hepatitis, looking up. That's the only way you can look when you're lying on your back. And believe me, God had my attention because God shouts to us in our pain. Pain is God's megaphone to arouse a morally deaf world.
Pain is God's megaphone to arouse us to a morally deaf world, C.S. Lewis. The Problem of Pain. Pain sometimes is necessary to accomplish the greater good. It's all part of the plan, and in the end, evil will be defeated. Many people want to know, okay, so God is all-powerful, all good. There's a reason, there's a purpose for suffering. It's the result a lot of times of our freedom of choice. If we didn't have freedom of choice, it would not be a God of love. We would be just mere robots and pawns in his hands. So I understand the whole purpose of free will. But what about evil? Will it ever really be defeated? Well, let's get an answer to that right now, as we continue and then end our discussion on why God allows suffering and evil.
Hook on to your syllogism, and they use it this way, okay? If God's all good, and we say that he is, he would defeat evil. If God's all powerful, he could defeat evil. But then they say, but evil never will be defeated. In other words, it's going to go on just the way it is here. Therefore, no such God exists. This is all, you're all pipe dreaming here.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what they're doing, because they don't know the end from the beginning as the God of Isaiah does. They don't know how things are going to turn out, and God does. So God, who knows everything, and God, who is all good, permits this, knowing exactly how much it will take to achieve his greater good. And he knows the end from the beginning, and he knows it's going to turn out well, because he's planned it that way, that he would permit evil to achieve the greater good. He would permit pain to produce the ultimate pleasure. He would let us go through the wilderness in order that we can get to the promised land. And, of course, when we get to the promised land and we look back on it, we're going to say what Paul did in 2 Corinthians 4:16. This light affliction, which is but for a moment, worked for us a far more exceeding and greater weight of glory.
Yeah, I think to the atheist who says that, you have a great note in your book. There's no way for the atheist to know evil never will be defeated unless he is God himself.
Yeah, he'd have to be omniscient. He'd have to know everything in order to know that it's never going to turn out well.
But let's come back to the guy that is in his bed and he's sick and he is suffering, like my mom, okay? He's in it right now. Okay, what is the basis? What are the hooks that he can grab onto that says, I can hope that it will be defeated someday up ahead?
I think it was about 1958. I was listening to Paul Harvey one day. He said he went into the hospital to visit a young man dying of cancer. He went in to comfort him, and he came out comforted because the young man looked at him and said, Paul, I don't believe that the divine architect of the universe ever builds a staircase that leads to nowhere. If you know you have a divine architect and he knows everything and he's all good, you can be absolutely sure that it's leading somewhere. I've been in that kind of bed. I've been there lying on my back dying of hepatitis, couldn't raise my hand. My wife and the church were praying for me. And somebody gave me a poem I'll never forget. It was called Overheard in an Orchard. Said the robin to the sparrow, I should really like to know why these anxious human beings rush about and worry so. Said the sparrow to the robin, I think that it must be that they have no heavenly father such as cares for you and me.
Mm.
That's the answer.
As we conclude our brief response to the problem of suffering and evil, evil will be defeated. Christ took the first step in dying on the cross to forgive us of all of our sins and rise again. There is a beautiful promise in the book of Revelation, chapter 21, the new heaven and the new earth. I think if you can grab on to this truth, you will know that there is an end to your trials and tribulations. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. And he who was seated on the throne said, Behold, I am making all things new. Also he said, write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. God himself will wipe away all tears from our eyes. Death shall be no more. There will be no more mourning or crying or pain. There is coming a day. There will be a day. A beautiful song by Jeremy Camp. Looking forward, evil will be no more. Suffering will be no more. Pain will be no more. And you can realize this beautiful promise and this beautiful truth. Give your heart to Christ when you come into a trust relationship with him, because he is the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. And he promises that there is a day when he is making all things new, when he brings good out of all of the suffering and evil that we've endured. You can know this for a truth when you ask Christ to be your Lord and Savior and realize that he is the sovereign Lord of the universe that holds everything together and has everything in control, because he created us and he will make us new one day. There is a promise that we can hold on to. Not a fairy tale, not a myth, but these words are trustworthy and true. I'm so thankful that you've joined me today on the cross in the desert. Keep your perspective on who Christ is. Keep the Yazidis in your thoughts and prayers as they struggle for daily living in this turmoil. I want to say I will see you again on the next Cross in the Desert coming up this Thursday. Have yourself an incredible week. God bless you. See you on the next Cross in the Desert really, really soon. Have yourself an incredible week.
Healing rain is coming down. It's coming nearer to this old town. Rich and poor, weak and strong, it's bringing mercy. It won't be long. Healing rain is coming down. It's coming closer to the lost and found. Tears of joy.